Now, this next talk was given in the synagogue Shabbat Bereshit, that's the first Sabbath after Sukkot. Dear friends, on this Sabbath we begin the Torah reading anew. There is a midrash that the Torah was the Lord's blueprint when he created the world. So on this day, when we begin the yearly cycle of the Torah reading, let us bear in mind that the Torah was indeed the fundamental principle upon which the world was based, but more than that, it is also the secret of the greatness and the survival of the Jewish people. Recently, sitting in a library, a man opened a conversation with me. He said, "Rabbi, I have read an article about Jews in America. I was intrigued by the high percentage of Jews on the college campus. Why do you think Jews are so enthusiastic about education? Is it because of persecution or constant wandering? Is that why you find education so important that it is necessary for survival?" I told him, perhaps. Maybe homelessness was a factor. But if so, a relatively small factor. For it was Jewish law more than anything else which made us a society great with students and scholars. And I quoted to him from Maimonides, "Every Jew is obliged to study Torah, rich or poor, of good health or ill, young or old. Even a beggar who must seek his daily bread at the door is obligated to learn Torah. And even a man with many mouths to feed must set aside a fixed time for Torah learning, as it is written, 'V'hagisa bo yomom v'layla.'" My library acquaintance was surprised to find that the study of Torah is an important part of all of our worship, and that there was universal compulsory Jewish education even 2,000 years ago. I even quoted to him from that beautiful answer to a question that one of the sages of the 16th century, the Masas Ben Yomin, gave, which explains why it's permissible to call a man to the Torah even if he's illiterate. And in seeking a precedent for this, he told how he remembered when he was very young, many, many years before, and he was in the very far reaches of Podolia and Volhynia, what was then called Eretz Rusya, that is, Eastern Europe, far away. It was then that last frontier on the way to Turkey, that there did exist in that remote location some Jews who could not read Hebrew, and even so the rabbis permitted them to be called to the Torah. Now imagine, in a Poland of the 16th century, when perhaps 1 in 10,000 of the Polish population could read, when even nobles and governors could not read, when even their priests could hardly read, the Jew had to travel all across Europe and delve into his childhood memory before he could find an illiterate amongst his own people. Thus was Torah regarded by Jews. Nachum Sokolov, the great author, journalist, Zionist, tells of his arrival in Vilna. Now, Vilna was once called the Jerusalem of Lithuania. When Sokolov reached the marketplace of that city, he saw 40 or 50 horses and carriages standing near a wall, tied up, and a boy was watching them. Sokolov approached the boy and said, "Ingale, tell me, where are the wagon drivers?" And the boy replied, "Sir, come with me, and I'll show you." He followed the boy through narrow streets to a run-down house. He went up a rickety staircase after him, and he entered a very large room on the second floor. And there he saw something which he never forgot. These wagon drivers all sat around a table with their books of the Mishnah open. A man at the head of the table led them in the study of Mishnayos. What moved Nachum Sokolov was that here was a group of people struggling very hard to provide their families with at least the minimal conditions of life, though substandard. People who worked 16 hours a day, who suffered all the privations of poverty and poor housing and exposure, in an occupation which was, to say the least, not the most respected in the community, the Balagola. And yet these Balagola felt the need to study in order to invest their lives with meaning and purpose. My father, Zichrono Livracha, used to tell me, how when you walked down the central street in Minsk, from every window there was the sound of Torah, of Tehillim, of prayer. It enveloped you. It was part of the atmosphere. It was part of the air you breathed. And of course, Torah was the passport of admission to leadership and to the social register of the Jewish community. Now, as it happens, the man in the library that I was speaking to was from India. And when I told him these things, he said, coming from a land of 14 languages and 380 different dialects, I can appreciate more than any other what a unifying force your religion and your Torah were in fostering and preserving a close relationship between Jews of different continents and cultures and civilizations. Now I can understand even better the reason for the incredible performance of that small state of Israel in every area, military, economic, cultural, even though it's surrounded by so many adversaries, so many challenges. Thinking about this conversation, I wondered about the future. Would we be able to maintain the standard of intellectual, spiritual, and human excellence? That will depend not only on the education of our children, but also on the continued education of our adults. For the continued education of adults is a measure, and the best measure, of how we regard Torah. Do adults stop learning? It is because they don't think it's important enough to take the necessary time from their packed and busy lives. Do they continue to learn? It's because, in spite of busy lives, they feel that Torah learning is important enough to merit primary attention. The challenge is that simple. And the future of our people will depend upon our response to it. Only one statement of halakha is enough to underscore what our attitude should be. And that is the legal rule that a school was even more sacred than a synagogue, and that a house of prayer could be converted into a house of learning, but not the other way around. Rabbi Asher ben Yechiel, one of the greatest of early rabbis, whose decisions usually became binding legal precedents for all Jews, ruled that if someone had established a foundation for such religious purposes as a synagogue or a Jewish cemetery, the community might at any time alter the terms of the foundation and use its funds for educational purposes, even against the will of the donor. But if, on the other hand, the foundation had been established for the sake of Jewish education, it must never be diverted to any other more strictly ritual use. In short, education is the most important of all of the commandments of Torah. It is therefore greatly to this synagogue's credit that it has made its Beis Knesses into a Beis Medrash, has provided learning opportunities for our people of every age. Thanks to the leadership of wise, far-sighted men like Louis Glick and all those who participate with him, there is now a Chevra Mishnayos, that Mishnah class which meets every morning before services and which is a pride of our congregation. And we have always had the Sabbath Talmud class and Torah class. Monday nights we will continue to teach Talmud to those who approach it with little background, and Wednesday we will have a more advanced class in my home. There will be Wednesday morning discussion groups in the library of the synagogue for women, and the couples and singles of our congregation are already sponsoring a Thursday evening monthly discussion group, and are planning to sponsor two more discussion groups, one of them in learning to read Hebrew and to daven from the very beginning, from Aleph Beis. All of these weekly and monthly groups will begin by the first week in November. Of them all, as well as the Mishnah class and the daily few minutes we spend learning after services too, we should be justly proud. It is the hallmark of maturity of our congregation that we seek more and more to hear the sound of Torah within these walls. God bless you all with continued vision and foresight to perceive in Torah the very life of our people. For just as the Torah was the blueprint of the world, so it is the secret of our people's survival. So it is that which will keep our community vibrant and Jewish and alive, and it will bring blessing to you and to your families, and all of us together. Amen. Be amen. Now I have another little story that I'd like to tell you, a story that I did not deliver in the synagogue, but that just came to my attention, and I think it's one that you will appreciate. It also has to do with learning, and with the fact that the symbol of Jewish learning has always been the tefillin. Placed on the head and the arm near the heart, the tefillin tell of the relationship between learning and doing, between intellect and performance. There is a beautiful and authentic story about Yigal Yadin, the general archaeologist, after the Six-Day War. He tells of the Qumran tefillin, and there seemed to be evidence that one of the parshiot, one of the portions that were written of the Qumran tefillin, were inserted at a later date than the other three, and that it wasn't the original one. In order to check this, he traveled by train from Jerusalem to Tel Aviv so that the fingerprint and identification department of the Israeli police could examine the parchment and determine whether there had been an illegal substitution. Not part of the story, but it is a fact that they really did discover that there was an illegal substitution. In any case, the train stopped at Kfar Chabad. A group of young Chabadniks, Lubavitcher Hasidim, got on the train. One of them went from person to person, asking them to put on tefillin. The passengers mostly refused, and so did Yigal Yadin. But the archaeologist noted that the Lubavitcher Chosid's accent was strange, and so he asked the young man where he came from, and he answered, "From Russia, and recently." "And did you put on tefillin in Russia?" asked the archaeologist. "Yes, from the day I became bar mitzvah until I came to Israel, I never failed." "In that case," said Yadin, "I will put on tefillin too." As the journey proceeded, one of the lady passengers approached and said, "The young man does not know who you are, but I recognize you. I'm very grateful that you put on the tefillin. You see, my son was the only Chabadnik, the only Lubavitcher Chosid in his paratrooper unit. He was killed in the war near Suez. And as he was dying from his wounds, they asked him what his last request was, and he answered, 'Put on tefillin.' And from that time till now, all the members of that unit, although most of them were not religious, put tefillin on regularly in his memory. Your tefillin today, can that also be considered in his memory?" Whereupon the general, to express his feelings, took out the Qumran tefillin, whose discovery was still secret, and showed her what he had in his case. "Tears," he said, "entered both her eyes and mine." Who can deny the romantic aspect of this story? Tefillin discovered in the cave of the Dead Sea after 2,000 years. A distinguished archaeologist whose interest in them was purely historical, as a record of a bygone past. The encounter with those to whom it was a matter of vital present-day application. The Chabadnik who in Russia, through tefillin, had defied the might of the Soviets by putting them on daily. His fellow Chosid, who had worn them as a paratrooper and died with the request that his comrades do so in his memory. Tefillin is the symbol of the Torah in its study and in its application. It's appropriate that we consider all of these facets of the tefillin, and then think of all the ways that the Torah has kept our people alive in every age and every clime, in every community, with all kinds of Jews, and in all kinds of... Thank you.